Jeremiah chapter 3, if you have your notes. Anybody not have the notes? Okay. Burl, do you see, do we have any of the notes back there for, do you see them? We have had them in the past. Jeremiah 3, it's the Jeremiah 3. Yes. If you don't have those notes and you would like a copy, yeah, I passed them out a couple weeks ago, but we never got to them. So, yep, I got hands up. Earl, thank you. Just bring them as you slide down to the front. That's fine. So if you would do me a favor, save the church a little bit of money on printing, right, Tiffany? Save the church a little bit of money on printing. We're working on that. Yeah, if you just slip your hands up, Earl will keep your hand up. Earl will get to you. Fold that and put it in your Bible, because we'll probably be in Jeremiah 3 for a couple weeks. So that way we save the church a little bit of money on printing, right? We got one more hand. So Lord willing, my wife's not here this week, so my goal is to get my office upstairs all set up. Hey, Burl. Burl, you had one right here. Oh, they're making copies. I'm sorry. We'll get to you. Thanks, Tiffany. And maybe we make 10 more copies than that. Yeah. Okay. So anyway, we're going to, Lord willing, get my office set up. Earl and I are going to be down here in the morning. And so that will be wonderful. So I'll tell you one other thing I'll announce in the next service. Last Saturday of July, we are having a work day party. I don't like clutter. We have a lot of clutter to throw away. We are going to pull a huge dumpster outside. And we are going to go through the garage and the parsonage. And I'll just be honest with you. We are going to probably spend $3,000 to repaint one of the vans. And the van belongs in the garage, not tables that we should have thrown away 15 years ago. Because we wouldn't be spending $3,000 to repaint the van if it was in the garage. Amen?
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm not, as I've said to the deacons, I'm not upset, I'm not being mean, I'm not, you know, I don't like clutter. And so let me give you the story. I had a wise old country boy Missouri deacon who was my junior boys teacher. When I was in sixth grade, he was my Sunday school teacher, and when I became senior pastor 25 years later, he was my deacon. And his son is going to come and visit next week. They live in just south of us, about 15, 20 miles. And his son is going to come and visit with us. If you need the, let's go ahead and put your hand back up. Burl's got copies. Who else had them? Okay, there we go. And anyway, we at Tri-City, before we moved to our new property, had saved so much, so many treasures. Y'all know what I mean by treasures, right? They ain't treasures. But we had a large Christian school and a college, and so you do plays, right? And you'd paint these flats. You know what I mean by the flats? You know, the scenes. And you would have volunteers spend hours painting the flats, and then you did two performances, and what do you do with 20 flats? Well, nobody wants to throw them away. They spend so much time building them. And nobody wants to get rid of them. And who knows, in 80 years, we might do that play again. Are you tracking me? We are doing the same thing with my kids right now. I got all their treasures that Mimi has saved for them. And I'm saying to my son, we're going to put them in a box and send them to you. And he goes, don't send me that stuff. I go, then it's going to get thrown away. Throw it away, Dad. Okay. I am not moving your stuff, my grandkids' stuff. My kids' stuff I've been moving around for 15 years. I am not doing that anymore. If you want it, that's good. We'll take out one little treasure for my wife to remember you by, and then we're done. You know, that's... So, yes, you're all smiling because you've all gone through this yourself at probably some other time. So, anyway, my deacon said to me, he said, you know, Pastor, he says, it's $100 a square foot to build. And that was 20 years ago. So, at the price of homes today, it's way more than $100 a square foot to build. And he said, that's really expensive storage space. And he said, have you ever thought that they call the place a store? Because that's where your storage should be. So anyway, we had actually built behind the church multiple stucco buildings that were 8-10 feet high by 20 feet wide, and there were like 15 of them. When I got there as pastor, all these stucco buildings were full of treasures. And when we moved several years later to our new property, we brought in those huge dumpsters, not the ones you see at construction sites at a house, but I mean the really, really roll-off, roll-on. We filled up 5 of those. We had over 100 broken desks for our Christian school because somebody was going to weld them back together one day. It wasn't going to happen. Not in my lifetime, not in anybody. But they were all stacked. Okay. So when we moved to our new church, I said, we're going to make the storage very difficult for everybody. So the platform at Tri-City, Tiffany and her family were just there, is about 2,000 square feet. It has room for 100 in the choir, 70-piece orchestra, 2 big grand pianos, organ. So it's over 2,000 square feet, the platform. So you know where the storage is? Under the platform. So the storage is about, you have to get down on your hands and knees. And we have roll-on and roll-out carts. And every ministry has a little section. So it's 2,000 square feet. We put sprinkler in there, but we only paid $50 a square foot for all that storage. So I have 2,000 square feet by, maybe it's 4 feet, 5 feet high. And that whole area is sprinkled, and every ministry, here's the teen ministry, here's the children's ministry, here's the lady, everything is on rolling carts. So everybody has all their stuff on a cart, and they can roll it back in music ministry, and they can roll their stuff back. And all my pastors were just aghast at that. They're, Pastor, that's so, how are we going to do that? I go, yeah, you know what? You won't keep stuff you don't want because it's too hard to get at. You'll only keep stuff you actually need. You know what? They only keep stuff they actually need. So, anyway, that was from a very, very wise farm boy who was a Korean paratrooper and jumped into Korea and with the 101st Airborne. And he just said it's very expensive to store stuff. It's $100 a square foot. So anyway, last Saturday, we're going to have some hamburgers and grill hot dogs and hamburgers and stuff like that. And we're going to have about a 3-hour party of... So all those desks, we're going to go up the gymnasium, and in about a week, I'm going to say, anybody that wants anything in the gymnasium, go get it. I don't want to hear, oh, you threw my precious treasure away, okay? You can go look. There's going to be cabinets up there and desks up there. I used to have people want to give me computers. You know what I learned? I don't accept computers. If you want to buy me a brand new computer, I'll accept that. But don't give me your 10-year-old computer and take a $3,000 tax write-off on it. I mean, I'm joking a little bit, but you get what I'm saying by that, right? I don't know the history of all the desks that are in the gymnasium, but those desks don't fit in any office. They're way too big for any office space in this ministry. They really are. We shouldn't have those. If we do get teenagers, where do they play? We got a bunch of old beat up desks in our gymnasium. Does that make sense? I hope I'm not offending you. I hope you're not getting your feelings hurt. But those are some things we have to do. So anyway, we're going to do it. And that's the last Saturday in July. If you can come and help us, ladies, you can help in the kitchen, or there's some other things I think ladies can do as well. We're gonna. So we have some little painting jobs. So we've got new air conditioning boxes. By the way, we've set the air conditioners. I've come in here a couple of times in the middle of the week, and our air conditioners are set at 70. And this place is like an igloo. In fact, there were penguins coming from the outside to live in our church because it was so cold in our church in the middle of the week. They were very happy with me when I unlocked the door. It was like Noah's Ark. You know, they were just all... the Ark encounter at SeaWorld or something. So anyway, we've set the air conditioners. They all come on at 11:59 on Saturday night to cool us down to 70 degrees, and they all go off about noon or 1 o'clock in the afternoon. So we're not wasting your tithe money and my tithe money on cooling a building when it doesn't need to be cooled. So anyway, but we'll have some fun on that Saturday. So I think it's the 31st of July. Anyway, Jeremiah chapter 3, they say if a man divorces his wife and she goes from him and becomes another man's, may he return to her again. So here is the scenario. Jeremiah is listing for them all the angst that God has with them, right? This is about 625 BC. They are 605 is when the Babylonians are going to come for the first deportation. So they're about 20 years away from God's judgment mapping them. But Josiah is the king. They're not going to find the law for five more years. Remember, the temple is torn down. It's a brothel. Josiah is just a teenage boy. He's now about 20 as the king. Jeremiah is about the same age, 20, 21. And they're trying to reform Judah. And these are the charges God is bringing against Judah. He says to them, is it okay by Deuteronomy's code? So Deuteronomy was written about 1400 BC. We're now at about 620. So 800 years ago, Moses wrote that that there is an allowance for divorce because of adultery. And I haven't ever taught you on that yet. Bottom line is, I believe God allowed for divorce in the case of adultery because of the hardness of their hearts. That's what Jesus says. What was the hardness of their heart? They refused to stone the adulterer. That's my understanding of the hardness of their heart. Because adultery was a stoning offense, right? Kind of keeps us not committing adultery. But the hardness of their heart, Moses gave them a bill of divorcement, said, okay, you can do that. And Jesus interprets that as saying, the only reason for the bill of divorcement was for adultery. And Jesus says, because of the hardness of your hearts. So some have taken that, and it's a perfectly legitimate interpretation. Their hearts were so hard, they wouldn't compromise, they wouldn't love each other, they wouldn't obey God, they wouldn't stay married. That's a perfectly legitimate interpretation. The problem with that is that I've been counseling for 35 years. I've encountered so many couples going through divorce when the one member absolutely would do anything to stay married. I mean, they would literally do absolutely anything to stay married. Then you've had situations where there's physical abuse terrible physical abuse, hitting, endangerment to life, those kinds of things. But the person that was in danger, if they would love to stay married. They didn't. So there was no hardness, like a hardness of their heart. They didn't want to stay married. They wanted to stay married. But the other person was so evil, so abusive, whatever the case may be, that the marriage was not possible. So consequently, my understanding of that text is that Christ's allowance for divorce is because they in that culture refused to follow the law and refused to make the hard decision. The woman has committed adultery, the man's committed adultery, and they wouldn't stone them. Because if you stone the person and they're dead, then you have a widower, and they're perfectly eligible to remarry. So Jesus interprets that Deuteronomy law by Moses. Jeremiah's going back 800 years and saying, but there's an addition. If the person was given a bill of divorcement for adultery and then they legitimately remarried, but then they got with this partner for 6-7 years and that partner, they didn't like them, was it allowable for them to go back to their first partner? And the Deuteronomy code said, absolutely not. You cannot divorce one, marry somebody else, and then go back to this person. That's not, under no circumstances, there's no reason for that. Even if there's adultery, no, you can't do that. So when Jeremiah brings that up, what he's saying to them is, but you guys spiritually were betrothed, engaged, married to God through the desert. He took you out. He saved you. all those metaphors that God uses, then you get into the land and you commit spiritual adultery. You follow the culture. You're more in tune with the culture than you are with me. And he said, wait a second, now you want to come back to me. Now you kind of want to, you know, you want to have your pagan idols and you want to have some Christianity. Doesn't that sound like so many evangelicals that go to church on Sunday? They want to come to church for an hour on Sunday, and then they want to think like the world, act like the world, talk like the world, live like the world, have the culture of the world, dress like the world, behave like the world. The other, you know, 6.75 days of the week. Well, that's exactly what the Jews were like. And God is saying, if a man divorces his wife and she goes from him and he becomes another man's wife, may he return to her again. Would not that land be greatly polluted? But you have played the harlot with many lovers. Yet God says, I'm making an exception. If you return to me, I will forgive you. So, in other words, this should never happen. You should not be married. Marry somebody else, go back to the same person, and yet you've done that spiritually, and God says, I'm still ready to forgive you. It was not possible for a woman to become another man's wife and return to her first husband, yet that's what Israel wanted to do, and that's what God was willing. He's so gracious and so merciful and so kind and so loving that he was saying, even though the Deuteronomic code, say that 10 times fast, the codes from Deuteronomy, how about if we make it the object of a preposition, right? The codes from Deuteronomy, even if those codes, God says, I will wipe those codes away because I love you so much. I will take you back. And then God says this. He says, lift up your eyes to the desolate heights and see. Now, understand that in Baal cult worship, they went to hills because Baal was the god of storms. And you have to think logically about how they viewed this. Baal was the god of lightning. Baal was the god of rain. Baal was the god of storms. So think Elijah. Remember, it was a drought for 3 years. Remember and it's like, throw water on my fire, and my God is a bigger storm God than your God. That was basically what Mount Carmel was saying. You can stand there and cut yourself and scream and holler for the God of storms who has failed you for 3.5 years, and there is a drought. There's no water in Galilee, and Galilee gets 40 inches of rain a year, and for 3.5 years, they got no rain. So, I mean, you want to talk about California wildfires or Colorado wildfires, at least you get some rain. They got no rain for 3.5 years. And what Elijah is saying to them is, your God of storms is no God at all. My God is bigger than your God, right? But if you think about it, the God of storms morphs into a God of fertility. Because they would look at, you know, when there was a storm, boom, grasses bloomed, corn blew, there was fertility. So the God of fertility, what I do is I offer my first child to be burnt to the God of fertility, because I'm telling the God of fertility that I will give you, in faith I will trust you, that if I burn my first child, you will give me many more gods, many more children, because you're the God of fertility. I mean, crazy, warped, but no more warped than a woman or a man today who pressures a woman who he got pregnant when she's 19. Take the life of your child because you won't be successful in life. A child will just drag you down. Right? Isn't that how we, it's easy for us to say that thinking was warped. Oh, I got news for you. 21st century America thinking, we're just as warped. We're every bit as warped. So, now, since it's a God of storms that morphs into a God of fertility, where would you worship this God of storms? Because the storms come from the sky, on top of hills. And Judea and Samaria is very hilly. Northern Israel, it's hilly, it's rocky. So, I mean, they have hills all over. When you stand in Jerusalem and you look out at Jerusalem, it's hill, 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 hill. In every direction, you slope down away from Jerusalem, but there's hills here and hills. So literally, they've created shrines to Baal and little alcoves to Baals and little god shelves to Baal on all these hills. And then they would go and have sexual immorality, because having sexual immorality with a priestess of Baal, when you were one in sexuality, you were literally one with the god. So the immorality, the sexual immorality, was a part of worship. So that was going to church on Sunday, was to go and offer your child on an altar, your first child, and then to be immoral with a priestess of Baal. That was an act. And you get the same thing in the Roman times when Paul tells them not to go to the temple. If you've ever seen a picture of, now I'm moving forward several hundred years, but a picture of the Ephesian god Diana. Remember in Acts where they yelled, "Great is the god of the Ephesians, Diana?" Diana, if you've ever seen a picture of her, she is a statue with 30 to 40 breasts, because she's fertility. It's about sexual immorality. And she is a statue with 40 breasts. Because in Ephesus, every woman, at least one night a year from the queen on down, had to go and be a temple prostitute. That's the world Jesus Christ invaded. That is the world of abuse to women. When we hear, "Oh, Christianity dehumanized women." Are you kidding me? Christianity raised women's stature. Because it said monogamy, one man, one woman for life, not polygamy, not going to a temple and having sexual immoral relationships with, you know, a faceless priestess of Athena or Baal. No, it's one man, one woman for life. Oh my goodness, how does that not raise a woman's status in society? So when he says in verse 2, "Lift up your eyes to the desolate heights and see." He's talking about where they committed sexual immorality and where they worship Baal, on the heights. "Where you have not lain with men, by the road you have sat for them like an Arabian in the wilderness." In other words, like a prostitute on the roadside, you have sat like a prostitute waving to guys, "Hey, I'm cheap." But this is a metaphor for their spiritual decline, right? "Therefore the showers have been withheld." So she had plied her trade, Israel, as a cult prostitute along the road, and was waiting for immorality as eagerly as a marauding nomad in the desert. So a marauding nomad in the desert would wait for the prey to come by, the caravan to come by, and pounce on them. And he says, you're enacting the same kind of way. Jeremiah 3:3. And he said, "You've polluted the land with your harlotries and your wickedness." And now notice, he gives them the same comment that Elijah had 250 years before. This is the same God, Baal. Same God. Jeremiah 3:3. "Therefore the showers have been withheld." The God of storms is not working for you. You can go have sexual immorality with the temple priestesses. You can go on the heights and you can worship Baal and then try to say God is our Father, and you can go to church on Sunday and then live like the world the rest of the week, because that's what they were doing. And he said that doesn't work. You don't get to be polygamous spiritually. You either serve me or you don't serve me. And he says there's been no latter rain. So they had two seasons of rain. You know how in Colorado you have certain seasons where it's drier and certain seasons where it's rain. So the latter rain was later in the year. The former rain was early in the year, the planting season. The latter rain was closer to the harvest season. And he says, so what's happened is you had rain when you were supposed to have it in the planting season, but then I didn't give you any rain the rest of the year, and your latter rains didn't come, and everything just... I mean, if you've ever farmed, I know what it was like. My dad grew up on a dairy farm, but they had a lot of corn and wheat. And if you went to southwestern Pennsylvania and it was August and they hadn't had much rain, my dad would drive. I could still hear my dad driving down the roads and saying, "The corn should be 2 feet higher. They've not had good rain this year." And he says, the latter rain hasn't come. Well, where is God judging them? He's judging them directly to the God that they are... So I meet people that would give up everything for a dollar. I mean, they are greedy, greedy people. You know what happens? They see their car seems to be broke, the air conditioner seems to break. In other words, God judges them by Baal. Baal is the god of storms, so I won't send storms. I'm greedy, so therefore I will cause all your investments to fail. I will cause your marriage to fail. God says the Old Testament Jew in the book of Psalms about their time in the wilderness, David says, God gave them the desires of their heart, but he sent leanness to their souls. The greatest judgment God can ever do is not physical judgment, but it's an empty soul. We're an empty soul nation, and I will close with this, and we'll pick up here in Jeremiah 3:3 next week. If you came in a little later, we do have the slips of paper, the outline in the back. You can pick that up after Sunday school too. But so I was just giving the briefing to a one-star general yesterday we met. And I said, you know, sir, going back about 10 years ago, I was the one-star general for the Arizona Guard, was a member of my church. So most states have one guard full-time chaplain. And if you've got, you know, in Arizona, we have, 7,000-8,000 guardsmen. So it's one full-time chaplain spread out over a state, you know, the size of Colorado. So they live all over the place. Can you imagine how busy that person is in counseling marital issues and family problems? And you can imagine. So I sat down with the general when I was his pastor and said, you've got two other really good chaplains doing X, Y, and Z. You can give them a pay cut. They'll take the pay cut to be a full-time chaplain. So I was explaining that to the new general. And here's the number I gave him. I said, sir, we're withdrawing from Afghanistan. And I said, we have spent trillions of dollars in a woe-begotten plan to try to bring a 7th century country in the 21st century in nation building. And he nodded. We all accept that. But I said, do you know that 4 times as many military members since 9/11 have taken their own lives than have been killed in combat in Afghanistan? He did not know that. 4 times. 4 times as many military members, Guard, Reserve, active duty, have taken their own lives since 9/11. We're coming up on the 20th anniversary of 9/11 here in, well, it's 2 months from today. I said 4 times, and yet I said when I talk to leadership about a full-time chaplain, they think I think I'm talking, you know, it's like a calf looking at a new gate. So let me give you another number. I ran this down when I was the director of the Air National Guard in D.C. Do you know how much the government estimates one military suicide costs the government in dollars? Forget the sociological impact, the family impact. $1.8 million. You got a death benefit. You've got counseling. There's just so many other things. You have long-term Social Security to a widow with kids. On and on and on and on. $1.8 million. I said, you can put a full-time chaplain into a technician status, and Dylan knows what I'm talking about, technician status. I said, you can put a full-time chaplain into technician status for $80,000 a year. So in other words, I said, at that rate, 21 states can have a full-time chaplain. And if 21 states, if those 21 full-time chaplains save one life in 1 year, the government's broken even if they do nothing else. Though, when you all give me up to do what I do as my part-time gig, it's those kind of conversations that I get to have with senior leaders. Because that's a one-on-one for an hour with a one-star general saying, here's why we need more chaplains. And he said, well, that doesn't even count, you know, saving the lives. I said, exactly, sir. I said, I just came from D.C. where I'm not sure saving lives is a big priority of theirs. I really am not. I spent 2 years on the inner side of that, and I'm just not really sure that's the biggest issue. It's budget fights. So let me talk your terms. This makes sense financially. It's $1.8 million for a suicide, and it's $80,000 for a chaplain. Anyway, we are losing our soul, and our suicide rate tells you that. That is our alcohol addiction rate tells you that. Our opioid rate tells you that. Our escape through drugs rate tells you that. Well, why is it? Well, Jeremiah tells them why it was for them, and it's the same for us. Father, thank you so much for your word. Thank you for an example. When we hear from people that the Bible isn't relevant, we know that's hogwash. Thank you for preserving your word for us. These events took place well over 2,600 years ago, and yet they're every bit as relevant to us today as they were then. Thank you for that. In Jesus' name, amen.